Well, today is the first day of 7 days of unleavened bread, a festival season outlined by God in the Holy Scriptures, and it's customary on this day throughout history to review the process by which leavening portrays how sin works in our lives. We're instructed by God to remove the leavening from our houses and food as we simultaneously work to search and remove sin from our lives. Well, Mr. Jackson aptly described that process in his sermon, so today I'm going to take a slightly different approach. The title of today's sermon is The Tyranny of Good Intentions. The title, The Tyranny of Good Intentions, was borrowed from a book about America's legal system written by authors Roberts and Stratton. I'm not going to wander into that wilderness, however, we'll just keep the title. We've probably all heard of the old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. The meaning behind this wise saying is that it's easier to avoid a problem when it is small rather than try to fix a problem when it's big. We can all probably think of situations in life where we could have made better choices, and then we would have been able to avoid a whole lot of problems later on. We can ask ourselves, which is easier, to avoid bringing leavened products into our houses in the first place, or cleaning and removing the leavened products after those items have been scattered around our houses for a while? Well, of course, it's easier and more effective to avoid the leaven or sin in the first place than attempt to clean it out later. Recently, we heard a sermon about habits, how difficult it is to dump bad habits and how challenging it is to adopt and inculcate good habits. Yes, that's precisely what we are to do when we are on the path to becoming the kind of people that God wants us to be. Now, we all have good intentions, good thoughts about what we want to accomplish, yet sometimes we make bad decisions that sabotage or get in the way of our goals. This same dynamic, good intentions followed by bad intentions, have been true among humans for the 6,000 years of recorded human history. Well, today is the first day of unleavened bread, the first day in a week in which we're to purge leaven from our lives, the leaven representing sin that we are simultaneously to put out of our lives. The days of unleavened bread were first mentioned in the Bible in Exodus 12, and we can go through that chapter about the importance from verses 15 through 39. About what we're to purge it out. And if we find any during these 7 days, it says in Exodus 12:15, that you shall remove it. So, because we can't expect that we will have found everything, just like in our lives. When we find something, we remove it. You take action to do so. And so we read that in Exodus 12. And then in Exodus 13, after these instructions, Moses says, in Exodus 13:3, Moses says something here to the people. He says, remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by the strength of the hand of the Lord brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. Continuing on in verse 7, unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days. No leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters. Well, these instructions are repeated later in the book of Deuteronomy and later emphasized in the New Testament. And we can find in Deuteronomy 16:3 and 16:4, it repeats those instructions. First of all, what to do, and then as Moses said, remember to do this. So it wasn't just a one-time issue. And when you do this, and you remember the leaving of Egypt in a hurry, leaving sin behind. Well, when we study the history of the days of unleavened bread, we read about how the Israelites, the children of Jacob, who was later renamed Israel, migrated to Egypt during a famine. And over the course of 430 years, the Israelites became the slaves of the Egyptians. The Israelites became captives and laborers for the Egyptian. Well, Egypt in the Bible is pictured as a type of sin. Just as the Israelites were slaves to the Egyptians, so were subsequent generations of Israelites, including us, slaves to sin. The idea behind getting rid of the physical leaven is to demonstrate how hard it is to get sin out of our lives. The Apostle Paul tells the church at Corinth, and by extension then he's telling us, to put sin out of our lives. We pick it up in 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6. In 1 Corinthians 5 and verse 6, "Your glorying is not good. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump?" So he's pointing out to a particular sin and saying, don't let this get away with you. You're going to have to put a stop to it because it'll leaven the entire lump. And reading on in verse 7, "Therefore purge out the old leaven," meaning the old sin, "that you may be a new lump, since you are truly unleavened. For indeed Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us." So they had an opportunity to go through Passover. Their lives were cleaned up. And they were purged. Now just don't go putting the old stuff back in again. Well, that's quite an instruction. Well, now let's take a look at how good intentions get people into trouble in the first place. Remember the view that it's often easier to avoid a problem in the first place than it is to try to fix it or make it better later. And I'm sure we each have our own examples in our lives where we can go back and say, you know, I think I'd change this, or I think I'd change that. And sometimes the list can be rather long. I know mine. I have a number of things that I would like to change and like not to dwell on that very much, and let's just move on. I'm going to give a few examples from the Bible to demonstrate the challenge of people who had good intentions, but things didn't work out quite the way they had in mind. And one of them is the example of Abraham. So let's take a look at the life of Abraham. Now, I put down in my notes the promises to Abraham. And this message will have a lot to do with the promises of Abraham because they extend to us. And I'm going to give a lot of scriptures. I don't know that you're going to have time to follow because I speak fast and I'm going to use a lot. So I just want to give you the impact of the idea of the promises of Abraham. Because we can see in Genesis 12 and verses 1 through 7 where God said, "I will make you a great nation. To give your descendants, I will give this land. In you, all families of the earth shall be blessed." Well, this is a promise to Abraham. We read on in Genesis 13, in verses 14 through 17. "I will make your descendants as dust of the earth." If he made my descendants as the dust in my house, that would be a lot of offspring. Okay, the dust of the earth is, I can't even imagine that great number. "With all the land you see, I will give it to you and your descendants forever. I will give it to you." In Genesis 15, verses 5 through 21, "Your descendants will be like stars." Now, I grew up in the country where there weren't a lot of city lights. You can go out at night and you can take a look and you can see the belt of the Milky Way. And the stars were innumerable. I couldn't count, possibly begin to count them. There were clusters of stars. And then, as I grew up and I went to an observatory, you could look through a telescope and you could see that what you saw before was nothing compared to what you could see when you look a little farther out. To one's descendants to be like stars is really beyond our ability to grasp. In Genesis 17, continuing the Abrahamic promise in Genesis 17, 2 through 8, "I will multiply you exceedingly, exceedingly fruitful, and make nations and kings from you. I will give to you and your descendants after you all the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession." So God is promising a great nation, many descendants, a place for these descendants. In Genesis 18, 18, "You will surely become a great and mighty nation." And it goes on to say, "In him all nations of the earth will be blessed." In Genesis 22, "Greatly multiply your seed as the stars and sand." Now, I've gotten sand in my shoe. I went to the Oregon Dunes. Took the family there with the kids and ran around in the dunes. And the idea was we would have a little wiener roast with the driftwood and such. So we climbed over these dunes, just like the Sahara Desert type dunes on the Oregon Pacific coast. Went over to the dunes, built a little, you know, hot dogs don't taste so good with sand in them. As the wind comes up, blows a little fine sand out. You cannot imagine how much sand gets in everything, in your shoes, in your socks, and then try to keep it out of your car. This is one little tiny experience of sand everywhere. And yet, your seed or your offspring, not just as the stars, but as sand. He's giving the idea that this is so much you can't possibly count it. In Genesis 22, it also, in 17:18, it also says, your seed or your offspring shall possess the gates of their enemies. And reiterates that in your seed all nations will be blessed. Well, we see that as those descendants of Abraham have had places of around the world in which they have controlled the great sea gates of the world. In Genesis 26, it again says, I will, in verses 3 and 4, I will multiply Isaac's descendants as stars. Well, Isaac is a son of Abraham, so those were his, in turn, would be greatly as part of the Abrahamic promise. And again, this promise was also that he would give to Isaac all of the lands, and the descendants would get the land. And by all of the descendants of Isaac, the nations of the earth will be blessed. So this entire expansion of the Abrahamic promise is continued on through Isaac. We continue to read it in Genesis 28, to give verse 4, to give Isaac and your descendants to possess the land which God gave Abraham. So we have father and son are passing along this blessing. In Genesis 28 and verses 13 to 14, Isaac's descendants will be like dust. So we're continuing that same thought as well, that dust. In Genesis 35:12, the land which I give to Abraham and Isaac, I will give it to Jacob. Now we have the third generation promise continuing on, and I will give the land to your descendants after you. So it doesn't just Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but to the descendants thereafter. In Genesis 46, verse 3, in Egypt I will make Jacob a great nation there. So this portends the time when Jacob's family will move to Egypt because of the famine. Continuing on in Genesis 48, I will make Jacob fruitful and numerous and give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. They were calling this the promised land, the land of Canaan. We read also about this promise in Exodus 6 and verses 2 through 8. I'll just briefly quote on the way by. We're doing a drive-by shooting today, I guess, so just zipping by because there's a lot of material there. And I will establish my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they sojourned, in which I will bring to you the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I will give to you for a possession. We continue on in Exodus 12:25. When you enter the land which the Lord gives you as he promised. This whole promise is continuing on. It's not once. It's not twice. It's many, many repetitions. We continue on through Exodus. And it continues to describe the promised land, or their blessing for the promised land, that we can continue to go through it. And then, of course, there are fulfillments to that promise. And we read about that and there are a list of verses, and we'll come back probably back to those in a few minutes. But all of these promises to Abraham and his descendants being a great nation, having the promise, for the promised land must have weighed greatly on his mind, for he had no children. Well, how can all of your descendants inherit the land when he had no children? And this weight must also have been on the mind of Sarah, Abraham's wife. Well, here's where Abraham, he was then called Abram, and Sarah, who was then called Sarai, greatly complicated matters with their good intentions. Since they were destined to have many descendants, and because they were old, they decided to shortcut the process and have children with a surrogate mother. Well, we read that in Genesis 16, and starting in verse 1. Now Sarah, Abraham's wife, bore him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, see now the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please go into my maid, perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai, and Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. And it went on that when she conceived, she despised her, was despised in the eyes of her mistress. things weren't working out very well from that point. Well, the price to be paid for this mistake was and is extremely high. It seemed to be a small thing in the greater view of Abraham's destiny, yet Abraham knew about God's promise in Genesis 12 that we first read, that his descendants would be a great nation, and then later in Genesis 15 or 13 that his descendants would be as the dust of the earth, or as the or in Genesis 15 his descendants as the stars of heaven. So he knew all of this, and of course, well, let's figure it out. Let's go figure that out. How is this going to happen? Even after the birth of Ishmael, of Abraham's son by Hagar, God renews the promise to Abraham in Genesis 17. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, "I am Almighty God. Walk before me and be blameless. And I will make my covenant between me and you, and I will multiply you exceedingly." Then Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of many nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you. I will also give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." Verse 15, "And then God said to Abraham," now in Abraham, "As for your wife Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her, and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of peoples shall be from her." Verse 17, interesting verse. "Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed, and said in his heart, 'Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?' And Abraham said to God, 'Oh, that Ishmael might live before you.'" In other words, I'm sure you mean Ishmael, right? Like, let's clear the air here. "And God said," verse 19, "No, your wife shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants after him." But verse 21, "But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year." Well, now Abraham knew the name of his son, Isaac. How many of us knew the name of our kids before we had them, before they were conceived, indeed? We move on to Genesis 18. And we hear a little bit more of the story. That was Genesis 17 we came from. Genesis 18. "Then the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre, and as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day," I can understand why you'd want to sit in the shade in the heat of the day. Even my sheep do that, you know, and they're not reasoning creatures. I saw them before leaving today, and they were safely under the shade, not out in the sun. So was Abraham. And verse 2, "And he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from his tent to meet them and bowed himself to the ground and said, 'My Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree, and I will bring you a morsel of bread that you may refresh your hearts, and after that that you may pass by, inasmuch as you have come to your servant.' They said, 'Do as you said.'" Now, of course, some historians and analysts say this is might very well have been right during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. We read on, verse 6. "So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah and said, 'Quickly make ready 3 measures of fine meal, knead it, and make cakes.' Abraham ran to the herd, took a tender and good calf, and gave it to the young man, and hastened to prepare it." Well, this is no small task. Quickly prepare a small feast. We saw how much we had to eat last night, okay, and how much there was left. So he took butter and milk and the calf. Well, that means he's got a lot of livestock. If he's got butter, that means fresh milk. They didn't have refrigerators. You couldn't just open the door and the light comes on in the fridge and you pull out the carton of milk. It wasn't happening. So that means milk the cow, cream rises to the top, churn the butter in order to do this. And so he took the butter and the milk and the calf which he had prepared and set it before them, and he stood by them under the tree as they ate. Now verse 9, and they said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And so he said, "Here in the tent." And verse 10, and he said, "I will certainly return to you according to the time of life, and behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." Now Sarah was listening in the tent door which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, well advanced in age, and Sarah had passed the age of childbearing. Verse 12, therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, "After I have grown old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" Verse 13, and the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'I shall surely bear a son or a child since I am old?' Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son." But Sarah denied it, saying, "I didn't laugh," for she was afraid. First thing you do is go into denial, right? I didn't laugh. Well, she did, of course. And he said, "No, but you did laugh." You know, there was an older fellow several years ago in California, and he and his wife had been receiving their retirement and Social Security for many years. And he was out of the house one day, and she went through the mail, and there was a letter that came from the local court. And it said that he was now notified in a paternity lawsuit that he should show up in court over the paternity lawsuit for this for a particular case. And the wife, and I thought of Sarah, she laughed. She threw the letter away. Didn't tell her husband when he came home because it was too awkward and embarrassing. She knew the old buzzard better than he did or anybody else, so she knew that wasn't going to be happening, apparently. Well, as it came out a month or two later, they were deducting child support payments out of his Social Security check. Well, now we have a problem, and he discovered this right quick. Well, what's going on? And his wife admitted, "Well, there was a letter came, but I laughed and threw it away. Couldn't possibly be true." So the man hires a lawyer, and he goes to court. And the judge says, "You received notice and an opportunity to be heard. You were adjudged in a court of law that you are the legal father of the child that was born." And the man protested and said he'd never received the notice. And the judge says, "The law says that any competent person over age of 14 in your household may receive that." And so the law adjudges that because you did not defend yourself and say no, you are the legal parent. Well, what had turned out was that the young lady who had the child and had initiated the paternity lawsuit indeed put the correct name down, but the government or the court clerk sent the notice to the wrong person with the same name. So the young man who had the same name never did get served, and the older man who was collecting his Social Security now got dipped 25% of it for the rest of his and her life, or for their lives. So laughing about a paternity case, probably not a good idea back when it was Abraham and Sarah, and it's still not a good idea today for seniors to laugh in that regard. Think about that from time to time when they say, "Well, that's not possible." Well, does God say, is anything too hard for God? Well, apparently they laughed and thought it was too hard for God because they had already made a decision. What was it, 13 or 14 years before? It was too hard to have all these descendants, so we'll just have to bring in a surrogate mother. Well, that certainly didn't turn out very well with the birth of Ishmael. Well, we read on then about how Isaac, the son of Sarah and Abraham, became then one of the patriarchs who went on to father his own sons, Jacob and Esau. But Isaac's descendants, even down to this day, have had great difficulty with the descendants of Ishmael, of Isaac's half-brother. If only Abraham and Sarah would have made a different decision, had only Isaac and not Ishmael, in that case, it only had one and not the other, their lives would be less likely to have had such complications of strife as we see even in the Arab-Israeli conflict as I speak. Abraham and Sarah had good intentions. They heard the promises of God. They knew these astounding promises, and they knew God kept his promises. but they took it upon themselves to make decisions that would shortcut the plans of God, and therefore, because they're going to help out God a little bit here. Well, do we help out God from time to time and shortcut the plans that God may have for us? Well, those decisions were made at a great price to Abraham and Sarah and to their descendants. So let's consider the example of Abraham and the Abrahamic promise, and that God had one of the greatest promises that that he has ever made to people. And indeed, those promises continuing on into the New Testament. If we read in Galatians 3 in verse 29, we read in Galatians 3:29, if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise. Well, if we believe in Christ, then we're heirs of Abraham. If we read in Hebrews 6, verse 11, or verse in chapter 13, 19 through 20, we have full assurance of the hope of an inheritance. If we also, continuing on in Hebrews 13, God made the promise to Abraham, this hope we have is one which enters within the veil, where Jesus entered as a forerunner for us. We also read in Acts 13, in verses 32 and 33, and then in 38. We preach to you the good news of the promise made to the fathers. Who are the fathers? Well, that's, of course, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That God has fulfilled this promise to us, their children, that he raised up Jesus, that through him forgiveness of sins is proclaimed to you. So all of this culminated then in the promise that extends to each one of us. So we can remember the example of Abraham and Sarah. They had good intentions, but when they wandered away and started making their own decisions, God found a way to make it work, of course. But it could have been less complicated. Hopefully we don't complicate lives. Hopefully God will see a way to do it, to bless our lives when we follow him. The second example I have is by Abraham's grandson Jacob. And I'm not going to go through all the stories of Genesis 29 through Genesis 35, but I will paraphrase them in a much shorter way. And what really was involved here was the ongoing sibling rivalry that came up because you had Jacob had 12 sons by 4 wives. And so this complicated family situation came to be because of some of Jacob's early decisions and a number of decisions along the way. And this complicated family decision, and then followed by behavior, which we read in Genesis 29 through 35, about how Jacob ultimately favored his son Joseph, the firstborn child of the wife that he first loved. The blended family complications then impacted not just them, not just their children, but for many generations to come. Indeed, it's still true today. It was Jacob's son Joseph's older half-brothers who sold Joseph to their cousins, the Ishmaelites. Well, isn't that interesting? I kind of like my cousins. And I have a flock of those cousins, and I kind of think they wouldn't sell me into slavery. But apparently there was enough antipathy in the family, enough uncomfortableness between the half-brothers that the cousins said, sure, we'll take them off your hands, put them on a camel or whatever they had for transport, and send them off to Egypt. We read in Genesis 37 how Jacob's sons, the brothers of Joseph, lied to the father about the death of Joseph and how the lies of the brothers caused Jacob great sorrow. Yet, had more care been taken by Jacob at the time of his marriage, many of these complications may have been avoided. Jacob had good intentions in his desire to marry Rachel, but what appears to be a series of mistakes at the wedding led to great consequences and sorrow for the entire family for generations to come. Nevertheless, God used the circumstances, despite the decisions of Jacob, to work things out for good. So the second sample we have is of Jacob, again, short-circuiting the process, going to help out God here a little bit by making sure that he has plenty of descendants. And then we have And then we have the third example, and that is I have of Moses. Now, Moses was used by God, and we know this story, to bring the children of Israel out of Egypt. They say between 1 and 2 million of the descendants of Jacob after 430 years came out of Egypt. And Moses was instrumental in bringing them out, and God used Moses to do so. Well, what happens when people are relieved or brought out of a bad situation? Is it ever good enough? Sometimes not. So what happens? They're out in the desert, and of course you're looking at, you know, it could be up to 2 million people. Takes a lot of water to take care of 2 million people, and they're in a desert. By definition, a desert doesn't have a lot of water, so that's where they're at. We pick it up in Exodus 17 in verse 1. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, how ironic, according to the commandment of the Lord, camped in Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses, saying, "Give us water that we may drink." I've been thirsty before. I suspect I've never been thirsty like what they're talking about here. Because when you have this many people and their livestock are all there traveling as groups, and we're looking at lactating mothers, we're looking at little children, we're looking at the cries of livestock. I know what it's like at sunrise in the morning if I haven't fed my sheep their little pitcher of grain, and the neighbors can hear the bleating of sheep. Okay? Forbid that I should ever let the water run, or let the water tank go dry. Or certainly, I'm sure that somebody would be calling about animal welfare, that the sheep weren't taken care of. Well, that's nothing compared to this situation. We follow it up with the continuing on in verse 2 in Exodus 17. And Moses said to them, "Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?" And verse 3, the people thirsted there for water. And the people complained against Moses and said, "Why is it you have brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" That's pretty, you know, thirsting to death is probably one of the most miserable ways to die. And I read I read something on that one time about all the parts of the body and what happens when you run out of water. Because you will thirst to death long before you'll starve to death. And that was one of the tortures that have been gone on through the ages of being mean or cruelty, is to put somebody in a prison or a jail and then let them thirst. We know that the one known as Evil King John, with whom later signed the Magna Carta in England in 1215, what he would do is raise the taxes on the noblemen, and if they couldn't pay, that he would seize their property. Well, the noblemen weren't too keen on that, particularly when he went to seize the property of one nobleman. The nobleman managed to escape, but his wife and son didn't get away. So Evil King John, back in 1215, he took the daughter and the son, put them in the tower at a prison in London, and let them thirst to death. And so we know these stories, because they're well recorded in history, that it's a terrible, terrible way to go. Well, verse 4, Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, "What shall I do?" This is verse 4, Exodus 17, 4. "What shall I do with this people?" And notice he's not saying, "What shall I do with your people or my people?" Just this people. He's pretty exasperated. "They are almost ready to stone me." Verse 5, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river,'" meaning parted the waters before their path. "'Go, and behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, and the people, that the people may drink.'" So Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. Verse 7, he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" Their faith was pretty weak. They had just been saved out of Egypt. They had just crossed the sea. It had been parted in a miracle before them. The fact that they even got out at all. There had been the case of the Passover and the death of the firstborn. There had been all the 10 plagues, the other 9 plagues before the death of the firstborn. And they saw all of this, and now they were feeling as though they were thirsting to death and thought, maybe God isn't really here after all. Well, the story, but the water came out of the rock. But the story in the book of Numbers has a little more detail than the one we read in Exodus 17. So let's turn to Numbers 20, starting in verse 1. The children of Israel, a whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. That's Moses' sister. Verse 2, now there was no water for the congregation. Numbers 20, verse 2. So they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. Those are brothers. And the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, if only we had died where our brethren died before the Lord. Why have you brought us up the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness, that we and our animals should die here? Now, if some of you have read or seen some of the depictions of the American pioneers as they crossed the prairie, and then they went out across all the way to the West Coast. In fact, some of you may have seen or played the Oregon Trail game, a video game about people crossing the Great Prairie and crossing the mountains and then some in the deserts. And there's this symbol of bleached bones out in the desert and people offloading things, people dying along the way. And families being reconfigured. It was a terrible. So I can imagine they had this similar thought. Did you bring us out in the desert just to die? to bring us, they call it, to this evil place. It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink. There's nothing growing out here, and there's not even any water to drink. Verse 6, so Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and they fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. So now we're in Numbers 20, and let's go to verse 7. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, gather the congregation together, speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation and their animals. Sounds good. Going to work a miracle. And so verse 9, so Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. Verse 10, and Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly before the rock, and he said to them, hear now, you rebels. Do you get the idea that Moses is pretty steamed? In other words, they were ready to stone him, or so he thought earlier, ready to kill him, and they're whining and fussing and carrying on. Of course, who wouldn't? Sheep certainly don't know any better. They would be bleeding, as were the people. Moses says, hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock? Well, the we, meaning Moses and Aaron, he was using Aaron's rod. Verse 11, then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Verse 12, then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. What did they say earlier? We read in Leviticus 17, they said, is the Lord even among us? And so Moses comes out and says, must we do this? Meaning he and Aaron, and struck the rock. So he wasn't giving the glory to God who delivered them. Instead, he made it look like he was able to do this. In other words, taking the power to himself and his brother Aaron. Because there were about almost 2 million people there to give water to, which has got to be quite a gusher, no matter how you look at it. I know Minneapolis, St. Paul has about 2 million people in it. That's an awfully big city. I don't know of any other city right around here. I don't know how big Kansas City is. That's a lot of water to feed a huge number of people. And yet, the price for this sin was high. Moses was to die before he could reach the promised land. He could see it afar off. Well, in each of these cases, Abraham, Jacob, and Moses, their intentions were good. At least initially, they were good. They wanted to do what was right. But unfortunately, they let sin creep into their lives. This sin clouded their judgment and produced sad results. Well, we can take the week of unleavened bread, to realize that just as it is quite difficult to get all of the leaven out of our homes, it's quite difficult to get all of the sin out of our lives. Yet each one of us should be hopeful because we're the spiritual children of Abraham, and the promises to Abraham extend to us. We read in Galatians 3 in verse 28, there is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Verse 29, and if you are Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. The sacrifice of Christ applies to us, allowing us to be the heirs of the promises to Abraham. Even though Jacob had good intentions, his decisions resulted in a blended and extended family that was a cause of many conflicts. Just as Jacob was redeemed by following his mistake, so is the sacrifice of Christ in place to redeem us for our mistakes. It was in a fit of temper that Moses took upon himself to present himself as the power that rightly belonged to God. And he did not personally get to the promised land, yet we find that Moses was greatly honored for what he did. Similarly, for what he did do. Similarly, we must avoid sinning in a fit of anger, lest we also find ourselves looking afar off at the promised land, but not getting there. Through these examples of Abraham, Jacob, and Moses, and many other biblical examples, we can learn that the most effective way to put the leaven, our sin, out of our lives is to not let that sin in there in the first place. We're grateful that we have a merciful God who provides His Spirit, His power to help us overcome sins, to put the leaven or sin out of our lives. We appreciate God's Spirit working with us and through us to lead us to good decisions, which in turn will lead us to better relations with others and ultimately lead us to eternal life. With God's help, we can avoid the tyranny of good intentions by turning our thoughts into positive choices.